kind of administrative remark really can mean that Lieutenant Leone would not be promoted again.
A high-level reprimand for the Coast Guard pilot and sole survivor of a helicopter crash. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, after more than a month, the North Slope well that suffered a blowout is plugged.
Cold weather certainly hampered a lot of the operations and restricted some of the things that could be done.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com.
The Coast Guard's commander in Alaska officially admonished a Sitka-based aviator over the weekend for his actions in a fatal helicopter crash. Three of the four people on board Coast Guard Helicopter 6017 died when it crashed in July 2010 near La Push, Washington. The helicopter's co-pilot, Lieutenant Lance Leone, survived the crash and faced criminal charges that were dismissed earlier this month. Leone met Sunday with Coast Guard Rear Admiral Thomas Ostabo to review a final report on the crash. Ostabo also entered remarks into Leone's personnel file that could mean an uncertain future for the aviator's military career. Leone's attorney says he'll challenge the admiral's official remarks. KCAW's Ed Ronco has more.
The 12-page final action memorandum, as it's called, comes from Vice Admiral Sally Bryce O'Hara. She's Vice Commandant of the Coast Guard in Washington, D.C. It says Leone and Pilot in Command Lieutenant Sean Kruger failed to comply with altitude restrictions, which contributed to the helicopter striking electrical wires between La Push and a nearby island. It says the flight plan listed a level of 1,000 feet, but that the chopper was below 200 feet for nearly two-thirds of its flight between Astoria, Oregon, and the crash site, some 125 miles north. The report goes on to say that minor procedural lapses, such as not completing required checklists, were followed by significant errors in judgment, and it says some pilots at Air Station Sitka have become habituated to low-level flight when conditions do not require it. Coast Guard spokeswoman Lieutenant Veronica Colbath confirmed that Leone met with Rear Admiral Thomas Ostabo, the commander of the Coast Guard in Alaska, on Sunday to go over the final report. Colbath says she cannot comment on the remarks Ostabo entered into Leone's personnel file and that the Coast Guard cannot release them. Leone's attorney, John Smith, also said he can't release Ostabo's remarks, but he said they echo the memo from headquarters, saying Leone's failure to perform his duties directly contributed to the deaths of his shipmates and the destruction of the helicopter.
Clearly, he's disappointed.
John Smith.
Having your commander, as well as the Coast Guard, the organization that you love, tell the world that you directly contributed to the deaths of your crewmates, your fellow Coast Guardsmen, that's a pretty heavy weight to put on somebody. I think that Lieutenant Leone would gladly take that on if the Coast Guard would, in essence, meet him halfway and take responsibility for what they failed to do. But that's not the case here.
Smith takes exception to a number of the conclusions in the crash report, but here he's talking about the wires the helicopter struck. Smith says the Coast Guard should have acted sooner on warnings it received about those power lines. The memo says the lines were marked on navigational charts, but it also acknowledges that a lack of adequate markings on the lines, quote, may have contributed to this mishap, unquote. The power lines were maintained by the Coast Guard and have since been removed and replaced with a generator. According to the report, the Federal Aviation Administration doesn't require markings for lines below 200 feet, but the warning balls that were attached were smaller than those normally used and were faded and required replacement. Earlier this month, when the Coast Guard dismissed the criminal charges against Leone, Smith said he was hopeful his client would return to flight. Leone was determined suitable to return to duty as a Coast Guard aviator last year, but his recertification was canceled when the charges were filed. The final report released this week directs Coast Guard officials to reconsider whether Leone is suitable for flight duty. Smith says that, coupled with the remarks in his personnel file, mean an uncertain future for Leone's military career.
This kind of administrative remark really can mean that Lieutenant Leone would not be promoted again. It's possible that his current promotion, and he is on the list to be promoted, might be relooked. We haven't heard anything from the Coast Guard yet about that.
As for the future, the report makes a number of recommendations and directives on how the Coast Guard can change its safety practices. For example, the Coast Guard will review the way it trains air crews to interact. It will develop the ability for a helicopter's crew to hear the same warnings that are available to the pilots, and it will study the feasibility of equipping Coast Guard helicopters with wire strike prevention systems already in use by the Department of Defense. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
The North Slope well that suffered a blowout last month has been plugged. Crews pumped cement into the well yesterday to seal it off. The Spanish company that owns the well, Repsol, decided it was easier to abandon the well than trying to get it working again. Jim Regg is a petroleum engineer with the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. He says cold weather hampered the well control operation.
There was a lot of mud and debris on the drilling rig that had to be cleaned up before they could actually do the work. And they went about it in a very meticulous, safe manner. So it's much better to keep our personnel safe and not create more of a problem than necessary.
The blowout happened on February 15th. Gas stopped flowing a day later, but extreme cold slowed the well control operation. Crews started working today to clean up the drilling mud that ended up coating the snow-covered area surrounding the rig. The Department of Environmental Conservation doesn't know how long that phase of the operation will take. The Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission is investigating the well blowout. A Galena man is being held at Fairbanks Correctional Center after making a fake emergency call that triggered a major search and rescue operation. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Troopers say 22-year-old Garrett Huntington called early Friday morning on his cell phone to report that he'd suffered a self-inflicted gunshot wound while traveling on the trail between Galena and Huslia, about 250 miles west of Fairbanks. Throughout that day, troopers searched an expanse of territory with a chartered helicopter and state airplane, along with several search and rescue groups that set out on snow machines from villages around the area. Rescuers eventually found Huntington at his home in Galena, uninjured. Troopers arrested Huntington and charged him with 2 counts of false reporting, 4 counts of disorderly conduct, DUI, and misconduct involving a weapon. Troopers brought Huntington to Fairbanks Correctional Center on Saturday. He was scheduled for an arraignment Sunday afternoon. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an enticing aid station for cross-country ski racers in Talkeetna.
Bacon, it's a bacon station. You gotta stop and smell the bacon once in a while, you know. Here you go.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation celebrates 4 decades of dependable financing and competitive interest rates for Alaskans. Find out more by asking your lender or real estate professional how Alaska Housing can assist you with buying a home. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
The House today exempted large nonprofits from being financially audited as part of their collecting donations through the Permanent Fund Dividend Distribution. The audit was required as part of the Pick, Click, Give program that allows people to make donations from their annual dividend. Anchorage Republican Mike Hawker, who opposed the bill, is a certified public accountant. He said the smaller charities, those with annual budgets of less than $250,000, are already exempt. He said the state needs to show the organizations have good financial management practices in place and exhibit some assurance of integrity.
I personally am very concerned that when we allow an entity to appear on the Pick, Click, and Give list, we are either tacitly or, and I'd actually suggest that we are explicitly telling the public that we support these entities, that they are all equally righteous places for money to be contributed.
Sponsor of the exemption, Homer Republican Paul Seaton, said some nonprofits don't participate in the program because the audit costs more than the amount of donations they get through it. He cited as examples the Literacy Project of Alaska, the Homer Council on the Arts, and the Ketchikan Arts and Humanities Council.
Originally, this bill got brought to us because of the Seward Senior Center. It has $260,000 in total receipts for their operating amount, and so it's about a $10,000 certified public audit every year, and they received $7,000 in the 1 year that they did participate. The object of Click, Pick, and Give is not to make small nonprofits pay more than they receive.
Seaton pointed out that every federally recognized nonprofit organization must provide public access to what's called a 990 form. That's a 12-page financial disclosure document required for certification. The bill next goes to the Senate for consideration. The House also today authorized a 5-year extension of the Renewable Energy Grant Fund. In continuing the program, the House informally agreed to contribute $50 million a year to projects fitting into the fund's requirements. Finance co-chair Bill Thomas, Republican from Haines, told members that the fund has distributed $176 million since it was first set up in 2008, and 21 projects have been completed. He cited the Gustavus Hydro Project for saving 27 cents a kilowatt hour, Cordova Humpback Creek Hydro for saving more than 10 cents a kilowatt hour, and Kodiak Pillar Mountain for saving more than 14 cents, reducing the sale of diesel fuel by some 10 million gallons statewide last year. Anchorage Republican Cherise Millett was the Energy Committee co-chair when the program was restructured in 2010. She says renewable energy has had phenomenal success in rural Alaska.
Sometimes we talk about if this program's going to last, if we can sustain this program. This is one that we should continue to fund. It has done great things for communities all over. And I think really emphasizing displacing diesel is the key, because that's what we really intended this bill to do back when we started the conversations.
Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra said Alaska stands far above other states with energy conservation, saying the grant program benefits urban and rural residents.
We know the price of fossil fuels is getting more and more expensive, no matter which one of us has the most brilliant idea on bringing oil and gas at cheaper rates to our consumers. Those prices are likely rising, and renewable energy stays the same price forever in most cases. It might start a little high, but 10 years from now, it's the same price. And 20 years from now, it's the same price because wind doesn't get more expensive.
There was no opposition to extending the program. The bill now goes to the Senate for consideration. The Alaska Volcano Observatory has been able to make some detailed observations of the Iliamna volcano on the west side of Cook Inlet. In recent months, the volcano has had elevated levels of earthquake activity. KDLG's Mike Mason has the details.
On Saturday, AVO was able to get an observation flight in the air to get up close to the Iliamna volcano. That flight also included measurements of volcanic gases. Steve McNutt in Fairbanks is the coordinating scientist for AVO.
The most important thing is the big picture thing is that the mountain is basically, you know, mostly unchanged from its normal state. The amount of gases coming out is a little higher than usual, and there were some modest changes on the high part of one of the glaciers, but nothing really out of the ordinary. So whatever's happening is mostly at depth with relatively few changes up at the surface.
A status report issued Monday afternoon notes that some deformation of the ice at the headwall of the Red Glacier on the east side of the summit was seen, but it's not clear this is related to the current volcanic unrest. AVO confirms that avalanching of the glacier is common on that very steep area. The last time it was seen was back in 2008. McNutt says it's not known if the elevated amounts of volcanic gases and the elevated seismicity is due to new magma entering the volcano.
That's an interpretation which comes from after some lengthy analyses. What's driving what we're actually seeing could also be related to gases. Now, then the question is, where do the gases come from? They probably come from magma. So either magma is moving or gases are percolating through the magma somehow at depth, and then the ground above and around it is responding by having earthquakes and other changes.
The observation flight occurred during a weather window Saturday, and observers on the flight saw vigorous and plentiful gas vents at the summit, which AVO notes would be consistent with elevated gas emissions. Monday's status report notes that the amount of gas being emitted is similar to the levels seen back in 1996 and 97. That's the last time the Iliamna volcano had elevated seismic readings. However, no eruption occurred. McNutt says if the Iliamna volcano were to erupt, scientists would anticipate seeing some warning signs beforehand.
The magma is still at considerable depth, and if it were to erupt, and this is reasoning by analogy with hundreds of other cases that we know of, you got to do work on the surroundings to get the magma from depth up to the surface, and that produces lots of earthquakes as well as deformation of the ground and extra gases and signs of heat. And so when you see all those things together, earthquakes, deformation, steaming, and heat, that's a clue. That's what you watch for to see if something, if the magma is pushing its way toward the surface. We haven't seen all that yet.
McNutt confirms that the Alaska Volcano Observatory will endeavor to make another observation flight to compare to what was seen during Saturday's observation flight. The volcano alert level for the Iliamna volcano remains at watch, and the aviation color code is at orange. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
The state of Alaska plans to start monitoring recreational beaches for paralytic shellfish toxins in a few communities this year. It will be the first time the Department of Environmental Conservation tests non-commercially harvested clams and other shellfish for the dangerous substance. According to program coordinator Dave Lowell, the state wants local involvement.
That's the kind of model we'd like to have, where the community participates in terms of collecting samples and shipping them to us for testing. Then the community is the resource that grows with the knowledge of the paralytic shellfish toxins and helps publicize the results and let consumers or harvesters know if there's a hazard.
Paralytic shellfish poisoning is a serious and sometimes deadly illness that can result from ingesting cooked or uncooked bivalves, like clams, mussels, oysters, and scallops that contain the toxin. The state regularly tests commercially grown shellfish for it. However, there have been a number of reported cases of PSP from personally harvested shellfish. This has been a particularly bad year for PSP in Southeast. Scientists found exceptionally high concentrations of the toxin in samples around Ketchikan last summer, and just this winter, there were at least two reports of suspected PSP poisoning. State health officials say PSP is not limited to certain months of the year, and Lowell is hopeful the recreational shellfish testing program will help raise local awareness about the problem.
Part of the issues that we have are that a lot of the PSP cases, paralytic shellfish poisoning cases, don't get reported. So we really don't know how many cases we have out there. And so we're looking for that community effort to build. And then the expensive end of it that has always been a kind of a roadblock is the actual testing and the shipping of the samples. And so a lot of the funding that we have is going to support that, so the community doesn't have to pay for that.
Lowell says the legislature approved $400,000 for the pilot program, which is expected to last for 4 years. The state will choose three communities to participate. There will be one each from Southeast, South Central, and Southwest Alaska. Tribal, municipal, and borough governments are all eligible to apply by April 6th. Meanwhile, the Aleutian-Pribilof Island Association is seeking funding for a separate PSP testing program for non-commercial shellfish around the state. APIA senior scientist Bruce Wright says Alaska is the only coastal state affected by red tide without a comprehensive state-run testing program. He's applied for several federal grants to develop a program that would test shellfish in many more communities.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD. Also, paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. 8 hours after you quit smoking, your blood oxygen level returns to normal. In 3 months, your lung function improves up to 30%. And 10 years after you quit, your risk of dying from lung cancer is about half that of a smoker. But right now, you're one cigarette closer to cancer. Every cigarette makes you sick, so quit smoking today. Information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
As a tough winter winds down on the Kenai Peninsula, efforts are being made to revitalize the local moose populations, which have struggled in recent years. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game approved aerial wolf hunting on the peninsula earlier this year, and now wildlife biologists have started a new high-tech study to learn more about what can be done to bring back the moose. KDLL's Shailen Cochran has more.
The Alaska Department of Fish and Game has chosen this year's most stylish fashion accessory for Kenai Peninsula moose, orange radio tracking collars. Biologists with the department have begun studies to gather information that might eventually bolster populations on the peninsula. Thomas McDonough is a wildlife biologist stationed in Homer. He says capture events have already happened on the southern peninsula, with more planned for other areas.
On the lower peninsula, we've already caught 50 adult cow moose. We'll be assessing their movements as they approach the calving period. And when their calves are born, we'll be monitoring the survival of those calves over time.
Cows are targeted with tranquilizers and immobilized from a helicopter. At that point, the animal can be approached and various measurements and samples collected while she's being fitted for a new collar. McDonough says that to gain the most insight, the targeted populations will need to be followed for years.
As with any data that you collect, the more data that you get, the more you understand the system. And with multiple years of captures and repeated captures and monitoring over the course of a number of years, we'll get a really good understanding of condition of moose and the productivity of the population.
He says even though they're in the preliminary stages, they've already started developing some ideas of what's happening to moose and why. He points to Unit 15A on the northern peninsula and the absence of fires that rejuvenate the browse moose are always on the hunt for.
It's a system that has had fire-influenced habitat changes over time as we look back in the history, you know, over 100 years. And there hasn't been a recent fire to change habitat to basically rejuvenate the moose browse. So our research will be able to tell what condition the moose are in and what those habitat variables relate as far as survival of the adult cow moose and their calves.
Fewer moose have been available for subsistence and hunting in recent years. McDonough says these current efforts are meant to provide information that hasn't been gathered in some time.
In the past, there used to be quite a bit of research focused on the Kenai Peninsula, mostly in the northwestern portion. And that's dwindled off the last couple decades. So the department recognizes there's a void of good quality information that we need to successfully manage moose. So this project has been initiated to fill that void and help us gather information to make better decisions to manage for long-term sustainability.
He says there isn't any one specific reason these new studies are being conducted, but rather it's for all the reasons moose are important to the local ecosystem that at least a handful of them over the next few years will be grazing in radio-transmitting style. Reporting from Kenai, I'm Shailen Cochran.
The vernal equinox means sunlight, warm snow, and fast skiing. One mid-March ski race has a distinctly spring break atmosphere that matches the community that hosts it. If it's springtime in Talkeetna, it must be time for the classic ski race. KTNA's Lorian Nettleton has more.
The starting line for the 2012 Usyk Classic Ski Race in Talkeetna was abuzz last Saturday, and race director Chris Mannix was visibly pleased with an unprecedented turnout of more than 700 skiers.
Boy, everybody in Alaska, everybody in the state, everyone who qualifies for a permanent fund is skiing today. It just totally astounds me that you can get this many people out here to ski this crazy race and have a good time.
The race has become for many an annual rite of spring, and participation has increased every year, nearly doubling in size from just 2 years ago. Part of the attraction is an effort by the Denali Nordic Ski Club to have a different course every year, and Mannix was especially proud of this year's trail. The race offers skiers two distances, a 50-kilometer and a 25-kilometer distance. While the elite-level skiers are in the race for speed, the majority of skiers are in it for fun, as evidenced by the number of costumes.
Where do you draw the line between costume and lycra? There are a lot of colorful people out here. I saw a nun out there and a giant chicken. Well, there you have it. That's the whole spectrum.
50-kilometer women's champion Rebecca Kanizny from Fairbanks repeated her win from last year, finishing in 3 hours, 13 minutes. She was followed a minute and 20 seconds later by Alaska Pacific University skier Laura Rombach from Germany and Greta Anderson from Anchorage. Kanizny suspects the secret to her success is springtime sunlight.
I think I'm solar powered. That's what I've been telling people, because up in Fairbanks in the middle of the season, I never really do much. And then my best races always come early in the fall when it's still like sunny out. And then in the spring, I just love it. Especially the last 3 years I've been in Talkeetna, I've done this race and it's been beautiful. The mountain has been out without even like a wisp of clouds on it. 3 years in a row now.
The top three places in the men's 50-kilometer race were taken by University of Alaska Fairbanks skiers, with Eric Soderstrom finishing in 2 hours 33 minutes. He was followed 3 minutes later by Ludwig Schott from Germany and Jonas Loeffler from Fairbanks. Eric Mundahl from Anchorage skied the longer distance, finishing in the top 10 with a time of 3 hours on the dot. He broke a ski pole just as he was passing this reporter on the trail, so I gave him mine to take the rest of the way. I asked him about his day when I finally made it to the finish line.
How did that 50K feel? What was the trail like?
Trail is great. This is probably my favorite trail. I've done the USIC the last couple of years, and this is by far the best. That 50K course was just amazing.
Did you feel faster and stronger in any way after picking up my pole? It was pink.
The pole was just, I was just happy to have a pole at that point. And it was awesome. Just amazing that it was exactly the same height as my other pole.
Mundahl says he declined to slow down for one of the most talked about aid stations along the route.
Bacon!
Oh my gosh!
All right, get your bacon. Like, the bacon station.
Hey,
and jelly beans. Bacon! It's a bacon station. You gotta stop and smell the bacon once in a while. You know, here you go.
Hundreds of volunteers are part of what make the USIC so much fun. Janice Tower's aid station was a hit with many, but evidently bacon isn't for everyone. The final finisher of the day came in so late, the timekeepers had already given up on Devin Barnhurst from Anchorage when he crossed the line just as the awards ceremony was starting.
How long did it take you?
Took me 7 hours on the dot.
What was your favorite part of the ski, aside from the awesomeness of being out there for 7 hours?
Probably the ski around the lake and the bacon station. Mm. That got me through that last 10K like it was no problem.
In true Talkeetna fashion, the post-race celebration featured a dance band and plenty of beer to speed up recovery from a long day on the trail. In Talkeetna, I'm Lorian Nettleton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Ronco in Sitka, Tim Ellis in Delta, Mike Mason in Dillingham, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, and Lorian Nettleton in Talkeetna. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Join business, civic, and government leaders from across Alaska and the nation at the 2012 Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference, April 19th and 20th at the Dena'ina Center in Anchorage. Clean energy is a $250 billion a year business worldwide, and Alaska has the potential to be a world leader in this growing field. Information at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. Local, national, and international news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.